For years, E. Jean Carroll was known for her sharp wit, her gonzo journalism, and then for her advice column in Elle magazine. She offered women blunt, unfiltered opinions that were mischievous, but always rooted in affection. And then, in 2019, she publicly accused Donald Trump of sexually assaulting her in a Bergdorf Goodman dressing room in the mid-1990s. Trump denied the allegation and repeatedly attacked her credibility. And that back and forth led to an extraordinary legal battle. Two juries found Trump liable for sexual abuse and defamation. The Supreme Court has let the first of those verdicts stand. And more recently, the Justice Department opened a criminal inquiry into Carroll's testimony about who had helped her pay for her legal fees. So Ivy Mirapol's documentary called Ask E. Jean is about the legal case, sort of. I mean, it has to be. But E. Jean once said that Donald Trump had reduced her entire life to 3 minutes in a dressing room. And Mirapol didn't want to do that in the film. So the documentary is a portrait of a remarkable woman, about her public life, but also about the private cost of what happened after she spoke out. We're partnering with the Utah Film Center to screen Ask E. Jean tonight. We're going to have more details in a moment, though they're pretty straightforward. The film starts at 7, and you need to RSVP. Today, the film's director, Ivy Mirapol, is with us. And one of the most distinctive parts about the film is the video from the depositions during the trials. The public has seen Donald Trump's testimony, but this is the first time many people have seen E. Jean Carroll's. You see her being questioned by Trump's attorney, Alina Haba, and there's one moment during the second trial when E. Jean is trying to describe what she sees as this underlying theme in her life, that when painful memories surface, her instinct is to bat them away.
E. Jean really looks worn out. She's stretched quite thin and not feeling great. And Alina Haba is really hounding her.
Okay. You mentioned that you worked hard to push the memories away.
And insisting that E. Jean describe exactly what it feels like when she has any kind of triggering moment or memory of the trauma of the assault.
An image or a piece of tape or just a flash of a photo will occur in my mind and I will bat it away.
What Alina Haba keeps doing is saying, I'm hearing all these, you know, things you're talking about, but I'm not getting any real answers.
So as you sit here today, you can't describe to me what that was, what you were thinking about.
Objection to form, you can answer.
I can describe to you an episode.
Sure, let's start there.
It's like a battering ram with Alina Haba trying to force an answer that really is difficult to pinpoint for E. Jean. These were things that she had tried not to think about for so many years. You know, being pushed into the dressing room or going up in the escalator. So here she is thinking about them again and then being asked to describe in detail. And what she remembers is the Access Hollywood tape.
My brothers and sisters and I were gathered at my mother's deathbed. And it was a very joyful time because we were recalling the highlights of my mother's life and she was enjoying herself watching home movies and our phones went off, the TV went off, and the Access Hollywood tape hit.
Use some Tic Tacs just in case they start kissing her.
My brain was taken over with images of Donald Trump pressing his mouth against mine.
You know, I'm automatically attracted to beautiful. I just start kissing them. It's like a magnet. I don't need to wait.
Donald Trump pushing me.
Grab him by the pussy. I can do anything.
Donald Trump raping me in the dressing room.
For E. Jean, I think that was a major moment, you know, that probably Alina Haba regretted because it allowed E. Jean to bring in the Access Hollywood tape to the story.
What does that moment, Ivy, sort of tell us about some of the themes in the film. I mean, it's the fact that she's trying to be tough and clearly affected by it. The fact that there was a moment when she felt like she had to come forth, when it was brought. Like, what does this moment say, do you think, about the larger story that you were trying to tell, do you think?
The larger story is how girls and women in our society are really, you know, kind of, it's ingrained in us to either, you know, not make too big a deal out of something, first of all, but also really, E. Jean still blames herself after everything that she's been through. And she even says, and I know I'm not supposed to feel this way. She absolutely still cannot let go of this deep-seated feeling that she somehow should have been smarter. Girls and women are expected to be the ones to take absolute responsibility for anything that happens. You know, were you flirting too much? Were you drinking? What were you wearing? All of these questions that we all know get asked, but then to really see the effect that that has on someone as strong as E. Jean and as independent as E. Jean, I think is quite remarkable. And I just keep feeling like if we can accomplish anything with this film and moving forward in this, is to get just E. Jean herself to not feel that it was her fault.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In 2019, when E. Jean Carroll first told her story about Donald Trump in public, it was in her book, What Do We Need Men For? Ivy Mirapol had read an excerpt in New York Magazine, and she said she had an immediate reaction to the writing.
You know, I keep trying to understand this myself as I look back, because it was just so instinctual. I read that piece. I knew nothing about E. Jean. I knew very vaguely, like her name was somewhat familiar, but I hadn't read her advice columns. I didn't know her as a gonzo journalist. Mm. And the piece was, you know, we were coming out of the Me Too movement, what people had been declaring, you know, was dead and all that. And I think so there was, I think the context, the moment was right for me to hear a new voice. And in this, in you know, talking about assault and rape. And I think at first I was just amazed that I was so engaged and entertained by this story that was also horrifying.
Yeah.
And I kept trying, like, how did she do both?
Right.
I'm like, how is that possible that I'm like, whoa, this is such a funny, wild, crazy New York story of, you know, running into Donald Trump.
And yet it's also gut-wrenching.
Exactly, exactly. But then all these details, like, she's just such a, I think she's a brilliant writer and a very distinct voice. And she managed to capture all of it. And I'm like, you know, you're looking at it, I'm as a filmmaker, I'm like, that's life right there in that one story. It is, and it's okay. And those two things can coexist. So in a way, I started to look at it as a bigger, almost an example of how we need to talk about things different. We need to talk about assault differently. And E. Jean will say, too, consent and non-consent can coexist, which is a way of looking at so differently than the way so many women are forced and still forced, but especially during the Me Too movement, which was wonderfully empowering, of course. But at the same time, I didn't feel that women could really tell the full story and say, hey, you know what? Actually, I thought it might be kind of fun to have a drink with this big producer and talk about my work and flirt a little bit or whatever. But you're not allowed to say that, because it's interpreted as you're saying, if you felt that way or you behaved that way, then you're asking for it.
Yeah. So you were hearing just candor, brutal honesty.
I was hearing brutal honesty, unapologetic.
Yeah.
Fearless, just this is who E. Jean is. This is who she was. But then on the other part of it was, here's a 75-year-old woman looking back and reckoning with her own past, which also felt very powerful and like something that could be really inspiring for people to hear.
We should explain that in many ways. Even though the film, the lawsuit, of course, the two trials with Donald Trump, are anchors for the film. It's not just about that. And in some ways, the core of the story is more about her. In some ways, it's linked, of course, but it's a profile. So I guess the question is, how much of the film is dependent on what happened with Donald Trump? Or did you want the core to be more about just her? Does that make sense?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, and that you're getting to the heart of what we grappled with and why it was very challenging to edit this film. And I have to give so much credit to my wonderful editing team, because it was very hard to marry all of those things, yeah, as you can imagine. But it all needed to be in there. But it was a process of like, okay, there's too much about Trump, there's too much about the case, there's too little of her, now there's too much, and really figuring out how to strike that balance. Hmm. You know, I always wanted the film to be bigger than E. Jean versus Donald Trump.
Well, I wondered about just how difficult it might have been from time to time to just kind of wrangle her and like what it was like to interview her, because you came up with a number of really interesting devices. You got her in front of a computer reading the press from the experience that she had been going through. So there's that. She and one of her best friends, they're having dinner, and that's really revelatory. It's not just a conventional interview. So you come up with a lot of different things. She isn't just she isn't just sitting there talking to you on a camera. There are a number of ways that you sort of have come up with to get her to talk about what happened.
Yeah. It's interesting to look back, because I didn't have a lot of time with her ultimately. I mean, I had some great long interviews, but I would have wanted so much more, and yeah, I didn't have that. So I feel very fortunate that I spent a lot of time talking to her about the fun parts of her life, you know, the exciting, the different articles she had written. And I think that was a really, I mean, I didn't ask her about the assault. I didn't need to. She wrote about it. And then we had the depositions, which I didn't know I would have until pretty late in the game. So I was definitely not sure how we were going to tell the story of the trials.
Well, that's so interesting, because so that was, that's what we see, the depositions. She doesn't tell it to you. That's how, so we're seeing it the way she's telling this attorney.
Exactly. So it's so powerful. I mean, it was an unbelievable gift that they gave us those depositions. So what happened was, you know, I was spending time with her. Yeah, definitely hard to wrangle. There were times where, you know, I had a whole crew lined up and then something would happen and she's like, we can't do it, or things like that. You know, she wasn't dismissive in any way. And she didn't. It's just that that's how she lives. And also she was having to listen to Robbie Kaplan quite a bit, which I understood. Yeah. So there was a lot of that, like kind of like an uncertainty, I'll say. So then I wasn't allowed to even film with her outside of the trial during that time. We were not working on the film. So I set it aside. I'm working on something else. Then I'm thinking, as we're starting to, you know, talk about editing and raising more money, how the hell are we going to tell the story of the trials? I can't just use news footage. There's no audio from the courtroom. The transcripts are riveting. I did attend the trial, the first trial at least, and we even thought briefly about having an actress play her, which would have been terrible.
Yeah.
So then I started asking Robbie Kaplan. I said, were the depositions filmed? I just didn't know. And she said, yeah, they are. Well, I mean, I knew, I asked the question because we had found Trump's. Now, the reason we were able to get some of Trump's is because when a deposition is entered into evidence in a trial, it becomes public.
Right.
At least in this situation, the federal trial. So Trump's was made public. 45 minutes of Trump's depositions were made public because it had been entered into evidence. E. Jean's, not a second of hers had ever been entered into evidence. Mm. So if we didn't make this film, if I hadn't been given those, access to those, to use in the film, they would never have been seen. They'd be in a vault still somewhere. Mm. So it was the trust that I had built with Robbie and E. Jean that allowed this to happen, that they gave us those, access to those. Because when I started watching them, I thought, this is it. This is, now we have not only E. Jean telling her story, but she's telling it in a way that she has got to be like, I mean, she was being deposed is no joke.
Yeah.
The stakes are so high, and she's just so, again, she's so honest.
Let's talk a little bit about, it's good to be, I think for those who sort of vaguely remember who E. Jean Carroll was or do know, it's good that they, to remind them of the role she played in the culture. And it's interesting because that's what you do in the film. And if, as you mentioned, she writes this piece for Esquire. Esquire buys it anyway. And her sort of career takes off. She becomes this gonzo journalist, you know, takes Fran Lebowitz camping for Outside Magazine. She moves in with her ex-boyfriend. She does this profile of William Hurt, makes out with him, writes about it. So I what does that tell us about her technique? She didn't ever think she was a great writer, but when you read her pieces, I think she is. And she also has this kind of playful, provocative approach to sex and this sort of penchant for questioning conventional wisdom. She's by no means a prude or anything like that. She talks blatantly about sex and power and relationships. And I guess that's why she took off, I suppose.
Yeah, well, I think so. She was really, I mean, the reason she became the most popular advice columnist in the country at that time, and then for 27 years, and also writing the pieces that you're talking about, is because she had such a distinct voice that was new at the time in the way it was, in the way her voice, she was telling women, specifically yeah. her readers in the advice column, you know, things that they weren't hearing elsewhere. Like, don't worry if you're not married at 30, you know, that's okay.
Yeah.
You don't need to be. You know, if you're bored at home with, you know, just because you're a housewife, go to college, do something. She was always saying, and that, but I love how she's, because she said this on her show too, you know, I want you to be more, not less. I want you to be more. And, you know, she talks about how in the 90s, women were coming into their own. They were talking about their jobs, in their careers and what they wanted to do, and that was new. That was new, and she was part of that because she had done it herself, right? So she had arrived on the scene in the very male-dominated magazine world, mm-hmm. and actually became the first contributing editor at male magazines, specifically, yeah. You know, Esquire and Outside Magazine and Playboy. So she was, as she, and she talks about this, a avowed member of the boys' club.
Yep.
And that's the club she preferred also. Mm. And I think another thing that the film kind of tracks, and it's maybe it's more subtle, is this idea of sisterhood and female friendship, which is a major theme in the film eventually for her, but I don't think it was a big theme in her life earlier. She did what she felt she needed to do to make it in her career. And she, as you say, she always says she's not a great writer. I think she's an incredible writer. But she believes, she knows she has an eccentric personality. She says this in the film, and that she brings that personality to her stories.
But then it's interesting, she tells you, as she's reflecting back on the advice columns that she did and the advice that she was giving on the TV show. Roger Ailes gives her a TV show, by the way. I don't know if people remember it. But she tells you she doesn't like reading any of that advice. And I wanted to talk about why. And this gets us to this moment, this Geraldo Rivera clip where they're talking about the Anita Hill allegations against Clarence Thomas, and she's, you know, she's telling women in the TV show in her advice column and here in this moment.
Anita Hill
on the one hand,
telling women to kind of suck it up.
If you look at the Anita Hill story, she complained about the Coke bottle, you know, about him making lewd remarks about pornographic films. And if she had merely said, "Shut up, Clarence." And the same thing with Paula Jones. She came into the room and he said, "I love your curves." And then he put his hand on her leg. And if, I think both the women are wimps. I think if they displayed any bravery or personal courage, they would have dealt with it on the spot and not have brought it into the country.
It's not that easy. It's not that easy.
Just tell handsy men to knock it off or shut up. And it's interesting to hear her reflect back on that and just feel, I don't know if ashamed is the right word, but she didn't like seeing that advice that she was giving.
No, and it does make her very uncomfortable. We would have these really interesting discussions because I would say, on one hand, I said, you were also giving, don't forget, you were also giving great advice that women weren't hearing.
Yeah.
I mean, you'd see the look of relief on her show, when she's telling some of the women, like, you know, stand up for yourself. This is, you know, she is trying to empower women, but she was trying to empower women to brush off things that actually should not be brushed off. And that's what she started to understand, I think. And what I've come to realize also is how much it's E. Jean's readers and her audience that she cared about so much that made her start to care about herself. She did not look at herself in the same way. She saw herself as almost like this separate being or something. I mean, she even says it at one point. She's, you know, I thought of myself as this invincible old lady. And that's what she wanted other women to feel also, invincible and strong. And what she started to realize is that it wasn't real strength because she was bearing painful.
Yeah.
You know, she's bearing pain. And so that's not going to be sustainable. And it also isn't, you know, fully recognizing. So she, you know, she would say things like, you know, I would tell women, you know, suck it up if you know, your boss pats your butt or something like that. And, you know, who cares? No big deal. And use your looks to get ahead. And then she said she finally has realized that you still don't get the promotion. You still don't get equal pay. You still don't get equal rights. And you also can be assaulted or raped and no one will believe you.
Ivy Meeropol. We're talking about her documentary, Ask E. Jean. You can join us for a free screening tonight at the Utah Film Center. You're going to need to RSVP. We'll put a link to that on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're profiling a documentary film that traces the legal battle between the writer E. Jean Carroll and Donald Trump. It's a case that became a reckoning over sexual assault and presidential power, but almost more than that, it's a portrait of a remarkable woman. We're partnering with Utah Film Center. We're screening the documentary at the Film Center in the Marmalade District of Salt Lake tonight. We'll give you more details in a moment. Today, we're talking with the director, Ivy Meeropol. There's this kind of, I think she describes it as this watershed moment. So she had sort of vastly oversimplified the responses that she thought women should be getting. And then Harvey Weinstein and the Me Too movement comes, and she describes being shocked. Tell us about her reaction to this. Do you think this was a trigger? It seems like it was, I guess.
I think it was. I think it was a combination trigger, and also she was just, as she says, gobsmacked. You know, she was just like, she couldn't believe that it was working. It's not just that the women were coming forward like in the way that they were. It was that it was taking him down. And I think that combination of like, wow, that actually, you can do that. It can work. Like, we, you know, there is some power there in numbers, strength in numbers. I don't, you know, or public exposure. Let me set the stage a little bit. She was on a road trip for her original idea for this book was to go to towns across the country named after women. And it was just kind of this gimmicky, kind of light-hearted thing. But she was going to go to these towns and just ask people, what do we need men for? And in the book, you see that it's kind of, you know, she gets some silly answers, some great answers, but it didn't have a lot of heft to it, that idea. So she's on the road, and that's when these stories are breaking. So she's asking women, what do we need? She's already wondering, like, what do we need men for? And I want to hear what American women living in towns named like Suzanne or something. I'm going to find out. But meanwhile, she's stopping along the way and picking up and reading the Times and New York Times and being like, just, oh my God. And so she then made her list of what she calls her hideous men. Yeah. It's her hideous men list. It's this somewhat funny, arch, knowing, and amusing way, right, of making a list of men who, it's a mix. It's a mix of men who kind of, you know, maybe came on to her too strongly, and then it runs the gamut all the way to being sexually assaulted by Donald Trump. So, you know, I think that it happened so organically that she started making that list, and then it was the list that made her start to think, wow, this is actually not okay that all of this has happened to me.
Well, you said that in some ways you've talked about how she at this point seems ready to look at herself and look at the advice that she had been given that she wasn't very proud of and make amends for that. I guess that's what.
And I wonder sometimes, honestly, I've thought about this now too, that her commitment to following through with this grueling process of suing him and then suing him again is her recompense for, or she is trying to recompense the women that she feels she didn't stand up for herself or even herself. It's almost like she's like, I don't like what I said about women, what I told women to do, what I believed women should be doing. Mm-hmm. Now I see it and I am in a position to do something about it. I really believe that.
It's so interesting too that it's actually, I think it's the first thing we hear in response from E. Jean to a question in the deposition of why she came forward now. And she says it's because he called her a liar. And that was the thing that, I guess, pushed her over. That was the thing.
Well, that was what pushed her to sue, yes.
Yeah.
So what pushed her to tell the story was, I think, just was... also, I don't want to forget to make it clear that it was her readers were writing to her during the Me Too movement, the height of it, asking her, all saying to her, I was also raped, I've been assaulted, what do I do?
Right.
So she was feeling that she wasn't being honest with her readers about her own stories. And that also was part of her telling the story. Now, the book comes out, the excerpt's published, it's a big bombshell because it's about Trump.
Right.
Now, remember, Trump had already been accused by 26 other women. It was not a new story that he was a sexual predator at all. But the story comes out, and then he's defaming her from the White House lawn over and over again. That's when she said, I'm going to do something about this, because she couldn't stand him calling her a liar. Hmm. She couldn't stand that he kept saying she's a liar and she's doing this for political purposes or money or to sell her books or whatever. She loves pointing out, by the way, that that book barely sold. So it's not like it was not, nor is it, you know, something that, you know, he made it sound like she's doing this just to like, improve her celebrity status and things like that. There's easier ways.
Yeah. I want to ask about, there's this, I thought this really interesting revelation she makes about her relationship with her mom. her mom sounded like a pistol. And so she gets this confidence from her mother. She was kind of a toughie, her mom. And she says it also made her tough. But she also said there was this other part. It also made her desperate to avoid confrontation. Explain that contrast. I thought that was really interesting.
Her mother, yeah, her mother was quite strong, but also quite adept, I think, at getting what she wanted or being in charge, even in the home, without it being a conflict to do so, if that makes sense. I mean, she's, it's a very traditional home, right? She describes her father coming home from work and they had to get, you know, have their hair combed and in dresses and ready to greet him, and her mom greeting him with the cocktail and the dinner ready and everything. But yet her mother was this very strong figure. So, I mean, I think the not wanting the conflict has probably more to do with, you know, when she talks about being, you know, the member of the silent generation, or the one she was born, the chin up generation, where you don't share your pain. You don't share your anger, even. You tamp it down. And she became very, very good at that.
Let's talk about the deposition. Well, there are two. The first one, where she talks about what had happened at the Bergdorf Goodman dressing room. And I want to talk about the candor. And you have said that she has a way of talking about sexual assault that you hadn't heard before. That when people are coming forward with a story about sexual assault, they feel like they have to kind of, you know, adjust the story or tailor the story. And this was something that E. Jean just would not do. Will you talk about that? Because I think that when we get to the stories in that she tells, she's talking about the banter, the kind of playful banter, the enjoyable repartee, I think is how she puts it, with Donald Trump prior to what had happened, and even trying, as she says, to recover that camaraderie after he had sexually assaulted her.
Yes, yes. Why laughing?
Yes.
It is so relatable to so many women and men who may have been sexually assaulted also, or try, you know, that you know, to try to take the danger out of it, the fear, like, oh, no, this isn't okay. Let's laugh it off. And then maybe it'll stop or go away, or like, because it had turned so quickly, too. And that's why in the film, I also was really determined to mix her writer's voice with the voice from the deposition, her voice from the deposition. Yeah. So you have a mix when we start that Bergdorf section. Well, we start it in the deposition where, you know, Alina Haba is like, well, take me back to what happened at Bergdorf. And then you see Jean kind of like girding herself.
This is during the years I'm doing the daily Ask E. Jean TV show. I'm going out the revolving door, and one of New York's most famous men is coming in the revolving door.
He held up his hand as I was coming out, so I stopped. And he came in, he said, hey, you're that advice lady.
I say, hey, you're that real estate tycoon.
What happened after he went through the revolving door?
Come advise me, says the man. I gotta buy a present. Oh, I say, charmed. For whom? A girl, he says.
And she's so expressive, too. I mean, that's why, like, as a filmmaker, those depositions are so powerful. You're just watching her face. But she, you know, she really didn't, you know, oh, God, here we go. So then we go into her writer's voice, which is and that's the writing that first got me, right? That's the same, from the same excerpt in New York Magazine. And the way she's telling the story, I'm going in, the revolving door, and he's coming out and he says, hey, you're that advice lady. And hey, you know, it's just kind of like this fun. It sets the stage for a more familiar, relatable experience than what she might have had to if she was if she flattened herself the way that, you know, a lot of we are expected to, or we feel we have to when we're bringing a, you know, a case like this. She couldn't have said any of that. She couldn't have said, oh, we're laughing, we're joking around, like, oh yeah, and now we're up in the lingerie department and we're he's throwing this that way and we're laughing. And I mean, it's, to me, it changes in a really fundamental way how we talk about and look at how rape and a sexual assault happens. It's much more likely to happen in this way than, you know, a dark alley with a total stranger.
Do you think that that could be influential for other women who are trying to make that decision of whether to come forward, whether to go through the process of a trial? Do I press charges because I also sent a text that was friendly or playful or engaged in sexual banter, or, you know, because E. Jean just leans into it. And I wonder if it'll influence others, or if the defense or if the legal process is still going to punish that kind of candor.
I mean, it's so hard to say. I mean, I think I hope that it contributes to a conversation that gets us somewhere more. But I mean, E. Jean would be the first to say, you know, how if she hadn't been put together Robbie Kaplan a certain time and a certain, you know, and have this story, it would have been very difficult for even for her to do this. And she had a lot of support.
Yeah.
So I don't know, it's hard to say. I think, you know, when E. Jean points out that if a woman is found to even have a sip of alcohol in New York, they will not even hear the case. Like, it won't, you know, won't even get past, you know, the initial claim. And so that kind of thing needs to be changed. I mean, that's a big one. You know, why can't you should be able to, you could have had five drinks, and that shouldn't be even be a factor at all. So I feel like things are, the law is still stacked against women. Absolutely. But it's a different way of talking about it. Let's hope.
Well, she does say, she's very clear-eyed about the fact that, you know, she mentions in these depositions, if women could see these questions that are coming at you. And, you know, and we see some of the questions, and among them, one which is really interesting, I noted, one of the questions was, at what point did they stop taking your article ideas? I thought that was really interesting because you could see a kind of, you know, strategy in there, that she's this washed up person who's looking for money. I don't know.
Yes. No, you're exactly, you are spot on. That is exactly what they were trying to do. And it's also just cruel. It's just like one of those things to try to take her down a peg. And she's so confident in there, you know? I mean, yeah. When did they stop taking your articles? Like, nobody cares about you anymore. That was all they had, really, was like that somehow she was benefiting from all this attention.
Ivy Mirapol, she directed the film Ask E. Jean, and we're screening it tonight at the Utah Film Center. You can join us. It's free. We're starting at 7. You do have to RSVP. We'll put a link to this on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take another break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. This is Radio West, and Doug Fabrizio. So you should come join us tonight at the Utah Film Center in Salt Lake. We're screening Ivy Mirapol's documentary, Ask E. Jean. The film premiered at Sundance this year. It's about the advice columnist and writer E. Jean Carroll, who publicly accused Donald Trump of sexual assault. Let's get back to our conversation with the director, Ivy Mirapol. You know, the moment when she actually, during that second trial, confronts Donald Trump in person there in court. She's quite vulnerable in a surprising way. Because she talked about how in when she was preparing with her lawyers for this, that she was really worried because when this idea comes up that she's going to be, that Donald Trump is going to be there, that she would freeze. And they were really worried that that's what, that was going to happen. But then, I don't know, do you mind telling the story how she looks out at Donald Trump at the actual moment and something else actually happens?
Yeah. So she, when they were prepping for the trial, which they did extensive prep work, and it was for the second one where Donald Trump was going to be showing up. And when Robbie in prep reminded her of this, she did have a day where she just... It sounds like it was really awful. I mean, they were worried about they were going to bring doctors in. She couldn't speak. She had a real breakdown. Mm-hmm. And she was just like worried. She was kind of feeling like, I can't do this. I just can't do it.
I was afraid I wouldn't be able to talk because that's what happened to me in prep. I just thought I was in deep shit. Deep. I was like this. It was horrible. And that was the moment. Robbie Kaplan is sitting here. She took me by the little hand and she said, "Good morning, Miss Carroll. Can you please spell your name for the jury?" And I don't know what happened. I looked out, there he was, and he was exactly zero. He did not exist.
For me, I think it was just her saying, like, she looked at him as completely separate from her, and he didn't matter anymore. It was like, he can't hurt her anymore. It was a very empowering thing for her to stop giving him so much power.
She was asked if she had sought help, gone to a therapist, and she said that she didn't want to dwell on the bad, and she sort of describes it as this generational attitude. You just sort of tamp it down. But the last part of the film really gets at this, the fact that she is still reckoning with that experience in that dressing room. The music had stopped, as she put it. Talk a little bit about that, if you would.
Sure. I mean, so this is something that E. Jean did not know about herself, or at least not consciously, right? So she was 52 when Trump assaulted her. She never had sex again. She had to say that. She talked about that with Leslie Leibovitz. She said that in the deposition. She's had to say it to herself, think about it, and reckon with this and put together what she had not done before, that wait a minute, it was after Trump, the Trump assault, that she never had sex again. But she'd never put it together before that. And I think part of that is her absolute resistance to giving him any power over her. So it's like this, it's this twisted kind of, like, by saying, I'm not giving him any power over me, which is also what she's saying to Anita Hill and all of that, is ultimately she gave him the full power because she was refusing to recognize that it had hurt. You can't get past it until, like, I mean, I think that's, like, we're really experiencing here with her is that he did hold that power over her still. And she didn't even know it. And so all of those years where she really loved being in relationships, she, as she says, she loved men, she liked sex, she was a very adventurous person, she was very open, she was comfortable with her sexuality, and then it just went away, and she didn't examine that herself. And now she sees it.
In May, the Justice Department started an investigation into E. Jean. And I'm wondering, what effect did it have on interest in the film? The film was out there at the time. And I also wondered, was it difficult to get people to pay attention to it? Like, how was it talking about this profile of this woman and this experience in the political environment? I mean, you go through what she goes through, which is this avalanche of slime. And I have to say, it's a really terrifying part of the film, honestly. She's reading these really vile, ugly things and, you know, death threats. I mean,
yeah,
dozens and dozens and dozens of them. And I just wonder, what it's like to talk about this film in this particular moment, because it seems like in some ways it's – you've said that it was less about the fear, you know, getting people to pay attention was less about feeling retribution or whatever, you know, from conservatives or, you know, the White House or whatever, that it was also that people were just tired of the Me Too movement in some way. And it seems like those two things were kind of playing out as you're trying to talk to people, convince them to see this profile that you had made.
You know, I will say that somehow I feel that the film has come out at just the right moment, in that I think people are ready to grapple with this again, meaning we have the Epstein files. I mean, the Epstein files and the Epstein survivors are, you know, they are part of the sisterhood with E. Jean. And being, you know, saying, no, we're not going to stop until people are exposed, including Trump. You know, what is in there? We need to know. And let's get, some justice for the victims. And so I think that in terms of that, like, there's a lot, I just think there's this groundswell of like, wait a minute, why is it like over and over again when a man gets in a position of power that their go-to is often, you know, whether they're like a gymnastics coach or they're a priest or a bishop or a, you know, whatever it is. It's just like, what is going on here? And I think this is part of the conversation. E. Jean's story is part of the conversation. And I'm glad for that. But it has been very hard. And the other thing I keep trying to say to people is I understand the reluctance. You think, I want to go to a film. Do I want to go to a film? And then it's just going to be this like horrific, kind of going over a sexual assault and hearing all the painful details. And then we're going to have to also talk and think about Trump in this film. And like all of that kind of conspires to be a tough sell, right? So, and I get that. I'm not, you know, I would never, but what I want people to know and what we were making, what we did with the film, and I think you see this, is that it's such a bigger story and it's a lot of fun because it's E. Jean. I mean, she's this incredible character. She's someone who, I think anyone who watches the film just falls in love with her, like you said, but also is just really excited, amused. You learn something, there's so much more to it than that. And I think that's really important. And that's what makes this film different.
Yeah. You know, seeing the role that she was playing in the 80s and 90s, you know, the advice that she was giving, some that she regrets, but some that was, as you said, empowering, telling women how precious they were and powerful they could be. It did make me wonder, is there anyone like her right now? And would she ever come back?
You know, if we're talking about younger women, I think some of the younger members of Congress, you know, like people like AOC even, what I would say is someone who could possibly, because she just has like, she's funny and but she's so political. So maybe that's not a good example. I'd have to think about that. You're kind of stumping me on it. I don't know who is out there who's like E. Jean now. But I will say that I also have thought that if she would be willing to come back and do some, you know, kind of an update advice show, I think it could be fantastic.
Well, Ivy Mirapol, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Ivy Mirapol. She directed the documentary Ask E. Jean, which you can see tonight with us at the Utah Film Center. It's free. We get started at 7, but you're going to need to RSVP. You can get details on our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We're on Instagram at Radio West. We're on YouTube at KUER90.1. You can email us at radiowest@kuer.org. Our intern is Aidan Oneida, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. I'm Doug Fabrizio.